Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host Brandon and joining me is Hale. Today we're going to be talking a bit about three thinkers, but kind of focused on one of them. So we're going to be talking about Heidegger's notion of the they. And so I've read Being in Time, a number of times. And when I read Being in Time and I look at the notion and the concept of the they or the one or das man, it seems to be not just a theme in existentialism, because I know that a lot of existentialist thinkers pull from Heidegger or are drawing on his ideas. But even when you look at some of the previous thinkers who were considered existentialists, and I'm thinking specifically of Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, they also had ideas that seemed to anticipate Heidegger's concept of the they, and not just in terms of an indefinite kind of social concept, but really there are some key features that get brought into the they. But also what's really interesting is the way that Heidegger kind of mixes things up and changes it for the 20th century. So we're going to bring up Nietzsche's notion of the herd, Kierkegaard's notion of the public, and we're going to talk about the differences and, you know, compare and contrast those, but also compare them against the they, and maybe we'll just have a discussion about those. I thought that would be interesting.
I was a big fan of Heidegger for a long time, and I still think he's someone who really influenced my philosophical thought, so I'm pretty familiar with, like, the concept of the they or das man, although it has been a while since I've really dug into Heidegger. And then I'm also pretty familiar with Nietzsche's the herd mentality, and we'll obviously talk about that as sort of like, well, actually, Kierkegaard precedes Nietzsche and that on the timeline. I'm only vaguely familiar with Kierkegaard's The Public, but I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff to say on this topic, largely because, and we'll talk about it more, I'll bring it up, but my sense of this has always been that in this sort of philosophical revolution that was the 19th, particularly the late 18th, but especially the 19th century, heading into the 20th century, with a lot of emphasis on kind of personal freedom that you find in stuff, even like the Romantic movement of the 19th century and such, that there's almost this kind of tension, right? Like, as if, like, this emphasis on freedom only really has a kind of importance in tension with the fact that, like, it's difficult to be free. And not so much just in, like, a political sense, that's kind of a different issue, but in this very, like, deeply personal sense that a lot of these people are talking about. And I think Heidegger, well, obviously we'll talk about more, but I think Heidegger's the they is the most encompassing conception of that. But I'm sure we're going to get into it. So it's going to be really interesting. I'm excited.
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting too. But I wanted to start us with Nietzsche, and I wanted to talk a bit about his notion of the herd. So I'm reading from the middle sections of Beyond Good and Evil. Yeah, Beyond Good and Evil, mostly because that's kind of where it's most concisely put. It's not his most developed notion of the herd. That would be in the genealogy of morality. But this is where he really lays this down and experiments with a genealogy of morality. He calls it a natural history of morals. So it begins from the premise that humans have instincts. We have habits that are passed on one way or the other, whether that be educationally, culturally, or whatever. I think that's the favorite way that we think of habits being passed on. But for Nietzsche, one of the ways that things are passed on is through a more material means. He uses the word breeding. He doesn't have an awareness of genetics, but he is working in the light of Charles Darwin and sexual selection in evolution and whatnot. There are ways of speculating about how that influences thought, but in any case, he does use the word breeding, for better or worse, for his theory. But in any case, humans have instincts. And one of the instincts that humans have for Nietzsche is an instinct to lead and to command. They have passions, they have projects, but they also have an instinct to follow, to obey, and to fall in line. And actually, Nietzsche says that we actively seek out, in a lot of us, you can see a lot of people seeking out, and you can explain a lot of behavior by referring to this instinct to submit and to obey. People actively seeking out, you know, all kinds of guidance and whatnot. I'm sure the self-help industry is responsible for a lot of it, which might explain a lot of why Nietzsche's popular in that book aisle.
And just to jump in, I think you brought up a really interesting or unique point of Nietzsche, or at least something almost a little bit revolutionary in thought, which is, you know, I think especially in terms of how most of us conceive ourselves or how we want to think about ourselves, we tend to obviously want to. There's this kind of championing of being like a leader, of being on top, of being, you know, the one in charge, all that. It's presumed that's what people want, right? But I think Nietzsche is very interesting in emphasizing that, like, these sort of social habits and these social conceptions of the self in relationship to other people, because that's basically what we're talking about with all of this kind of stuff, is, you know, that perhaps even more ingrained is that, you know, the will to follow instead of like the will to power, right? Like the will to fall in line, to listen to people in charge, to take orders. And it's something that, like, everyone pretty much does, frankly, more frequently than being in charge of anything. And it's really interesting that Nietzsche, like, brought that out.
Yeah, I find it in my own experience, when I really reflect honestly, when I'm told, you know, I'm a part of a team or something, and I get instructions, I'm really excited to do my part. You know, it feels good to fill a role. And I think that is an expression of that instinct to obey. And it seems to fit in line with what Nietzsche is talking about in terms of herds and whatnot. But it's also symptomatic. I think I like your assessment of it, that it kind of shatters a little bit of the illusions that we have about things. Like, one of the things that Nietzsche says expressly is that, like, look, when you look at things like Stoicism and Christianity and whatnot, that holds these very self, you know, these ascetic, self-centered philosophies and ways of living. Really, these are not the will establishing its own power. These are actually symptoms of submission. You can explain these by reference to something else. These are not people controlling their own fate. This is them finding an outlet for an instinct that they otherwise have, which I think is an interesting way of looking at it. But in any case, so humans exist in groups, and one of the groups that they exist in is a herd. And Nietzsche defines a herd as a group seen through the aspect, you know, you can look at groups in lots of different ways, but a herd is a commander or a leader that has followers or people who obey. It's basically leaders and followers. That's what a herd is, essentially. But also in the life of the individual and in the life of, you know, this constant process of breeding in and out, commanders, leaders, and obedient and followers, there's a proportionate relationship between these. So as you lose, you know, leaders, you also gain in the obedience instinct in that way. And
is that for the individual or for the community?
That's interesting. It's for the individual, but the individual being a part of the community will flourish throughout the community. He says expressly too that obedience is inherited best, and we'll get to why that is. So in a way, there's a certain natural tendency towards obedience. And one of the ways that this can, one of the tipping points for this in any given herd is that the commanders succumb to what he calls the moral hypocrisy of leadership, that they stop commanding for the sake of commanding because they're passionate, and they start saying things like, I'm just following the will of the people, or I'm doing this for the sake of God, or I'm doing this for the sake of my nation, or something like that. Nietzsche would say that the instinct has been mixed in some way. They gratify their need to command by also gratifying a now inbred, you know, instinct for following. So, and this is this is Nietzsche's genealogy of the common good, right? So before, you didn't have any conception of a common good. It was just what the leaders wanted. If you were obedient, you obeyed. And if you were a leader, you got what you wanted because you could command these people. Now you have commanders who do things for the sake of the community, for the herd's sake. And this is where the common good arises.
Yeah, and I mean, you think, for listeners to think about it, would be how even heads of state often refer to themselves as civil servants, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they're serving the people, the president is serving the people, the prime minister is just, he's just another civil servant for just like the average citizen.
Mm-hmm. So when the herd has a sense of its security and whatnot, it's because it has some kind of threat to it. But once all of those external threats have been, you know, removed or eliminated through whatever process, once there is nothing threatening any herd, that doesn't mean that that instinct to preserve itself doesn't go away. The common good, the notion of the common good is still there. And what can happen is that the threat can, or the instinct to look for a threat and to address it just turns inward. It looks at the only thing that there can be to look for a threat in, and that's itself. Right? So what happens is a fear of one's neighbor starts arising, and this fear is what gets called immoral or evil. This is Nietzsche's genealogy of morality, kind of writ small in a way. But the point is that this is directed inward, and it's directed inward at the members of the herd. So what happens is if you show too much, you know, if you have too much passion, if you are too much of a leader, if you're not doing things for the sake of the common good, if you're doing things that are risky or dangerous or that are even potentially destabilizing, that instinctually bred feeling of the common good, even in those leaders who have been leading the herd, they will start to level out those passionate individuals. They will denounce them as evil. They are not, they're not proper. They are immoral. To be moral in this particular herd would be to be average. It would be safe, not to arouse fear in others, because what the instinct is looking for is things to be afraid of, because it hasn't been, there isn't really a rational process for looking for things. There just is that instinct that has been bred in this community. Now, he says that in the future, there will be the new philosophers or the free spirits who have done, they've gone through this genealogy of morality, and they've seen that it has arisen for basically random reasons. It's just an outcome of inheritance of morality and herd behavior, essentially. And with this, having a full grasp of the circumstances, they'll see it as contingent, and it'll shake up the possibilities of morality. For them, they can see alternatives to the moral landscape that they're living in. He says that the track that this is on is happening in Europe at the time, and it's called progress. Progress is the hope that there is nothing to fear at the end, you know, at the end of this whole progress or of this progression, there will be nothing to fear. All immoral things will have been eradicated because we know what's right and wrong, but the free spirits will be able to envision alternatives to this particular train of moral development because they understand that it has arisen under very particular circumstances that they themselves can change. I think this is what makes Nietzsche's assessment particularly, I don't want to say scary, but that we can manipulate our own sort of moral fates in this way. It throws an abyss under where we felt there was ground. We get to make decisions about what we think is right and wrong and how we condition ourselves.
Can I say what you say scary? Can I say what I think? You know, that's what I used to think. I said, oh, it's scary, can be used for evil ends. And obviously, probably many of our listeners are familiar that, like, people like the Nazis and every other authoritarian leaders were at least somewhat familiar with Nietzsche's work. I'm not going to claim any of them were, like, Nietzschean scholars. But to me, when I hear it now, what I honestly think is that it's naive. I think that Nietzsche's conception, particularly of, like, the free spirit, and I think this is where, and we'll get into it later, where I think actually Kierkegaard, but especially Heidegger too, more solidifies this conception of the herd, the they, the them, whatever, you know, the dust man, where it's like Nietzsche has this conception of, obviously, with, like, the Übermensch and all this kind of stuff later, these great philosopher type people who will develop beyond the bounds of less sort of known framework. And to me, I'm very skeptical of that. I don't think that people can escape their surroundings, the world that they're enmeshed in quite that way. And I think that Nietzsche was a very unique person in being able to sort of see through his own period and see through his own moral framework and be quite accurately in some ways able to sort of trot down a genealogy, but was mistaken in many ways, as many philosophers I think are, in that, like, the theory, knowing the theory somehow activates an action. And I'm not someone who really subscribes to that.
The thing with Nietzsche is once you grasp that this morality is contingent, that it arose out of certain circumstances, and you really grasp it could have been it could have been a different way. Things could have gone differently. Morality could have found itself on different rails. I think that is what the liberating aspect of his philosophy is supposed to be. But I kind of agree with you that the horizon has been largely set. I don't know if we can necessarily, I mean, maybe in individual form, you know, that's why he calls them
sure.
New philosophers or free spirits, but you're not going to have you're not going to have individuals who usher in new ages of moral horizons.
You know, some Zarathustras out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's always the person reading Nietzsche that thinks that that's the thing. Yeah. But the other person who I see as, I see an analogous concept in Kierkegaard, who also is anticipating Heidegger. And I should say, too, we know that Heidegger read both Nietzsche and Kierkegaard quite closely. So they absolutely had some kind of influence.
Let me ask you, because I think I haven't answered this, but it's been a little while.
Sure, yeah.
But for our listeners, whether Kierkegaard or Nietzsche, do you think one influenced Heidegger more than the other?
Well, yeah, that is a good question. I mean, I know that, so if you read Heidegger's Being and Time, there's a specific moment in the second division where Heidegger coins the Augenblick, the moment. And he says that he's actually kind of cribbing that straight from Kierkegaard, that the solution for his problem of the call of conscience essentially comes, at least it has a phenomenologically, it comes from Kierkegaard. He says that there's an experience that Kierkegaard is talking about that I am citing as the phenomenological evidence for the call of conscience, which is interesting because a lot of people in trying to analyze the call of conscience in Being Time have said, where's the phenomenological evidence? Like Hannah Arendt says that in The Life of the Mind, there's just no evidence for something like a call of conscience happening. But Heidegger says it happens. Go read Kierkegaard. So yeah.
Fair. Yeah.
But this is, I think that was in, I don't know what work he's drawing from when he's reading that, but this is a different work. It's a smaller work. It's one that I think is a good introduction to Kierkegaard. You can't go wrong with the classics of Fear and Trembling or But in any case, this is from a smaller work called The Two Ages, and it's where Kierkegaard is going to be elaborating a notion of a public, and especially the mechanics that the public uses to enact what it does, which is called leveling. But where Kierkegaard starts out in the Two Ages is with many distinctions between what he calls the two ages. Before, so his picture is that he has a before time and a now time, the present age. In the before time, there was the age of revolution and the age of passion. People could act decisively. They could make decisions. Kierkegaard says that decision is the little magic word that existence respects. But now we live in the wimpy current, you know, the present age, where nobody is enthusiastic anymore. Nobody is decisive. And if people are acting, it's not really because it's on any kind of passion. And so we have to look for the reasons why people do the things that they do and why they have the character that they have now, because people are still going out and doing, you know, stunts and feats and adventurous. They're still going on adventures and they're still cultivating all kinds of experiences, but it doesn't have the same character as the passionate, heroic actions that people were doing in the past. So he introduces lots of what he calls them principles, but we'll focus on one principle in particular, which I think is central, and it is the principle of contradiction, which is that when you decide to be one way or the other, you have to choose one of those ways. You can't be both, right? So if you're going to be a good person, that precludes the possibility of being a bad person, right? And if that's too abstract, we can think of it also in concrete terms, right? So if you want to become an erotically oriented person, a person who satisfies themselves, that precludes the possibility of cultivating the virtues of chastity and, you know, temperance and whatnot, which is another way to be in the world. You could legitimately pursue being a chaste person versus being an erotic person or a lustful person. But the point is, according to this principle, you have to be one of them. You can't be both, because they're definite ways of existing. If you were to try to be both, that would be an indefinite way. You would kind of collapse what it really means to be erotic or what it means to be chaste. Now, we find ourselves in a particular existential situation where, well, it's always been possible to be the opposite of decisive, but we find ourselves now more and more in this age engaging in the opposite of decisiveness, which Kierkegaard says is reflectiveness. We have become reflective. So instead of seeing the possibilities and being charged to take one of them, instead, we stop and we kind of weigh it. Do I want to be, you know, do I really want to satisfy myself? Well, only on, you know, Fridays, but I want to be responsible and I want to be able to go to work on Monday, but not too much because I don't want to be a bore. You know, when I go to work, I want to at least be a real person. I don't just want to be a workaholic. So you're doing all kinds of this reflection.
This almost like an internal bargaining a little bit constantly.
Kind of, yeah. It is a bit of an internal bargaining because at the end of the day, you are going to have to settle on one of these. The principle of contradiction still holds, but it's that you're trying to find a middle ground in a certain way. But the important thing, though, is that since you have changed the mode of being, you have stopped being decisive, you have started to be reflective, you have kind of nullified the principle of contradiction. You found a way to have both, right? If you were active, you could choose one. You might waver, but then you would find your way back. The reflective person is different than the active person who falters because they never make a decision, ever, right? The tension in the active person is that they're trying to maintain a relationship with their decision, but the reflective person is just trying to maintain the reflection itself. They are trying to maintain a state of non-decisiveness. Now, being an active person, both of them require, or being being active and being reflective both require effort. But in the case of the active person, when you go and you do something, it's you exercise yourself, it's enlivening, you cultivate the ability to do that further. Whereas reflection is the opposite. It is actually enervating. It is a tension that wears you out over time. And so you slowly stop. It's kind of self-defeating in a certain way, not just it frustrates its own ends, but also existentially. You will eventually come to a point where you have to stop being reflexive and you have to unify yourself. And the principle that the person who denies the contradictory choice, the unifying principle for the reflective person is envy. The way that they show themselves singularly is through envy. But envy has to replace the enthusiasm of action. So instead of us going out and celebrating the excellence of another person, instead we envy that person because we never got to make our own decision. We kind of held off on that. And that also goes for ourselves, that we stop ourselves from doing things because we're kind of envious of the fact that we didn't. It's really strange. I mean, think about the times where maybe you've thought about doing something, but then you said, no, that's stupid, you know, because you saw someone else doing it and you said to them, they're stupid for doing that thing. You kind of transferred that to yourself and it stops you from doing that as well.
And I also think you've done a wonderful job of describing this. And you know, before we say any more, I'll just want to say that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. Your host today is Brandon, and I'm the co-host Hale, and we're discussing the concepts of sort of the crowd, the herd, the they in existential philosophy. But I think you've done a wonderful job of explaining that. There's a lot to unpack there. You know, the first off, I also think that, you know, another existential kind of famous existential concept that sort of comes to the fore when you're discussing this is this concept of anxiety, at least like in practice. I know and I want to say also Kierkegaard's conception, as you've explained it here, really, I think to me at least, resonates a lot with modern persons and their character. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that in relationship to media, which is a favorite topic of you and I. I'll speak as a millennial living in 2024. There's so much stuff. There's so many options. There's so much shown to you. Settling on a decision, making a commitment, is so easy to do and so easy to back out of. And there's always this like anxiety. As you talked about foreclosure earlier, it's like, how can I really pick and commit one thing when I'm constantly inundated with this notion that there's so much stuff I should be doing or I should be good at or I could be good at or whatever it might be? And this feeling of envy is very pertinent because it's, again, it's kind of like tension where it's like, we envy the people who seemingly have like committed to something. But then also too, like the commitment itself is incredibly frightening, especially for my main state of character. If I'm constantly bargaining with myself and who I'm trying to be and who I want to be, and I want to have that, you know, Kierkegaard talks about how, in the age before, people had this passion, this revolution, this decision. All those are characterized by this, an almost kind of like a focus, a level of commitment. Whereas like the present age, if we're constantly being inundated by new realms of possibility, if that's like the main emphasis, then commitment in any kind is kind of antithetical to that way of being.
Yeah. Yeah. Commitment is antithetical to the way of being that we exist in, where we are presented with all of these possibilities. And I think I'm glad that you brought up the media, because Kierkegaard explicitly is going to cite the press as the kind of material agent for what he is going to call leveling. And essentially, leveling is just when envy gets its teeth into the age, into the, you know, the zeitgeist. We exist in an age of